Welcome to the In Context War Report, produced by MDR Productions, Inc. The In Context War Report is broadcast at noon on the fourth Monday of the month on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. Our website is incontextreport.com. I'm Gus Cantavero, the producer of the War Report, and here's your host, Ken McDermott-Rowe.
Hello, everyone. I'm Ken McDermott-Rowe. Gus and I are joined, as usual, by the War Report's military affairs commentator, Marchand McDermott-Rowe. In the War Report, we report on recent developments in war and geopolitics around the world. By placing these developments in historical context, we show how they affect global stability and U.S. national security. Let's start today with the recent terrorist attacks in France, in which 17 people were killed, including 11 at the French satirical newspaper Charlie Hebdo. Gus, could you give us some more background information on these terrorist attacks?
The magazine Charlie Hebdo is a satirical magazine which really pulled no punches and attacked all religions and all different viewpoints around the world. So they really didn't particularly go after Islam, but the attacks that they had on Islam were particularly venomous, I think. Now, there were obviously no violent attacks in response to its attacks on the other religions. This is the only one that has been singled out. And there was previous attacks where the offices were firebombed, and that prompted them to increase their security in the aftermath of another satirical cartoon where they depicted the Prophet Muhammad in a negative light. The perpetrators are Sharif and Said Kouachi. They were brothers. The older brother is Said, the younger brother is Sharif. And they were killed by French police on the 9th of January. The attacks were on the 7th of January. They went into the magazine. They killed 17 people, and three of those were cops.
11 at the magazine, 17 in all the attacks altogether.
Okay, yeah. That's correct. Okay. They were filmed by a number of cell phone cameras while they were trying to escape the scene. And one of those was the source of the controversial footage where they were seen running up to the downed officer who was begging for his life. And one of the brothers ran up and appeared to shoot the officer in the head. But when zoomed in on that video, that's where the controversy started. And you can see the poof of air coming out of the muzzle. And then you could see a ricochet on the pavement just beyond the head of the officer. And there is no blood and there is no apparent damage to the officer's head. Now, we're not going to try to speculate on this, but if you just look and judge the footage for what it is, it's very confusing to me, and again, produces more questions than answers. Something that I think should be analyzed a little bit more closely by the general media, but they just simply refuse to acknowledge that this footage exists. There's been a lot of coverage about the degree of military skills by the gunmen. The UK Telegraph in particular, I think 2 days after the attack, had an article. The attackers displayed a degree of skill and calmness that comes only from advanced military training. And then in the subtitle of the article, they go on to say how they adapted a gesture adopted by radical Islamists where he pointed his index finger in the air while running back to the vehicle. And they were trying to insinuate that this he was saying God is great, God is one by this symbol. But I disagree, and I've looked at a number of NATO Western hand signals that are basic training for team operations, and I believe what he was actually saying was rally point one. When he put his finger in the air and made a circle, he was saying rally point one, which is the vehicle. It was meet me at the car. It wasn't an Islamist gesture at all.
The way they moved down the street, as depicted, as shown in the video.
As a team,
one was looking out, covering for the other. These guys clearly, as the Telegraph said, had military training, fairly high level. They were also wearing masks, right?
Right. They had balaclavas, so no one could see their faces at all. They were heavily armed. They had flak jackets on with spare magazines. There was a rumor that was not proven that one of them had an RPG. I have not been able to find proof of that. Then going on to analyze it a little bit further, you know, that raises questions. Is this state-sponsored? Were these men trained by professional intelligence operations? Were they undercover? I was just waiting for the identification to be made any minute now for the patsy. That's really what I was expecting.
Well, how do we know that these two brothers were the two masked men?
We don't. Well, the only way that the media has portrayed them as being those men is that they left their IDs in the car. Right. Which is completely out of this world to me, because they were smart enough to know the day they did their homework. They knew the day that the magazine had its staff meeting so that everyone was there, because more normally artists work from home and they really don't need to be at the office. But on Wednesdays, they had their meeting. So they knew how to get in, where to go. They need a kidnap somebody and use their key card to get into the office. But then they're so stupid that they leave their ID in a car, ditch that car, hijack another one, and escape the city. If they're smart enough to have an escape plan, which is really not go along with the traditional Islamist suicide bomber plan where they go down in a blaze of glory,
right.
These guys actually wanted to get away, and they did.
So it's pretty bizarre they would leave an ID
and very getaway bizarre.
But according to the press reports now, Sharif, one of the brothers, had served time in prison twice for his militant Islamic activities. So he was known to the authorities. In fact, he was known to be part of a network that shipped Islamic fighters to Iraq to fight with Al-Qaeda against the U.S. and U.K. occupation after the 2003 invasion.
Occupation. Now, the other thing that's very suspicious to me that, again, raises more questions than provides answers, is that the brothers were connected to Anwar al-Awlaki, the famous American imam from Virginia, who was killed by a drone strike with his son in 2011. Now, al-Awlaki is an important figure because he was connected to three of the 9/11 hijackers at his mosque in Virginia. And he was later connected to the U.S. intelligence when he was a dinner guest at the Pentagon shortly after 9/11. Now, after meeting with the Pentagon officials, al-Awlaki was then connected in 2009 to Major Hassan, who perpetrated the Fort Hood shooting. And the FBI intercepted 18 emails between al-Awlaki and Hassan. Later on, he was connected to Umar Farouk Mutalib, who was the famous underwear bomber. Mutalib was under surveillance by the CIA and was admittedly allowed onto the plane because, as was revealed in congressional testimony, they reported that they had eyes on him. That's a quote. When they were asked if they should allow this guy onto the plane because he had no passport.
Yes.
And the CIA said, let him on the plane. We want to know where he's going and what he's doing.
There was an attorney, I believe, who witnessed this conversation.
That's right.
But there's more to these terrorist attacks than meets the eye. One of the other wrinkles of interest in this French case is that French police commissioner, Helric Frédoux, who was investigating the case, he was...
and this is very, very suspicious.
His team was interviewing people who knew the brothers, and he had debriefed them. And as he was writing his report, it seems, he committed suicide. In the police station,
right.
Which seems very bizarre.
But just after he finished debriefing his officers, after they finished speaking with the family members of the deceased, he writes his report and then kills himself. And the report that he was writing has not been found.
Yes, there is no report.
So it doesn't sound like suicide to me. It sounds like murder.
So the whole thing does seem ripe for speculation. And the Russians have charged that the United States was actually behind the attacks to punish France because President Hollande of France suggested that France might no longer participate in sanctions, the economic sanctions against Russia. Now, the Turks, they have another angle on it. They claim that Mossad did it to punish France for voting for Palestinian statehood at the United Nations. As you may recall, this was a very close vote. The proposition to grant statehood status to Palestine only lost by one vote. And in fact, the French did vote in favor of that. The U.S. only had one ally voting on its side. No, that was Australia. So obviously Russia and Turkey, they have their own agenda. They're not at all objective in this. But it shows that different theories will surface and we may never know the truth. March, could you talk briefly about Operation Gladio and how it relates to terrorism?
Well, absolutely. Operation Gladio was a NATO stay-behind operation started at the end of World War II with the beginning of the Cold War. The idea was that NATO would form, with the U.S. at the lead, would form small guerrilla armies throughout Europe, and their job would be to conduct acts of sabotage against Soviet troops were they to invade. Now, during this, we hired a lot of neo-Nazi elements, lots of ex-Nazis, ex-Italian fascists and whatnot were hired to take part in this state-behind operation. But rapidly, the operation became as much about suppressing the domestic communist elements as it was about stopping the Soviets. And in fact, Gladio operatives were caught perpetrating terrorist attacks in Rome. There was one where a German Oktoberfest was bombed, and it was found out that the operatives, it was blamed originally on the communists, and the operatives who took part were members of Gladio. And there was another shooting that occurred in Belgium in a supermarket, which was, again, to be blamed on communists. And it actually turned out these men were members of Gladio. So there is a history.
One of the most famous was a Bologna bombing of 1980, which killed 88 people and wounded 200.
Oh, yeah. And there's a history of the United States sponsoring radical elements in order to either alienate something that we feel is far more dangerous. In the case of Gladio, was the Red Menace.
The Red Brigade actually was the name of the group that they utilized in order to throw the scent towards radical leftists. But in fact, the Red Brigade, which was ostensibly perpetrating some of these terrorist acts, was infiltrated by the CIA.
Absolutely. And so, I mean, there is a history here of sponsoring radical elements. Now, how much of this was directly the handlers telling them, listen, perpetrate these bombings, so we can blame the Red Brigade, and how much of it may have been autonomously their decision is up to debate. But the fact is that we knew they were perpetrating these acts of violence. We blamed it on the Reds, and we still continue to fund and support these radical elements.
And of course, one of the most famous crimes was the kidnapping and assassination of Italian politician Aldo Moro, who seemed like he was going to form a new Italian government, including the Communist Party. And this was, of course, anathema to the United States. So just to sum up, we don't know who was behind the terrorist acts in France, but we are suggesting that there is a tradition of state-sponsored terrorism.
That's right.
And that it behooves us to look critically at the material that's presented to
us. And to be more specific, these guys may not even know that they're part of an operation, but I mean, they're clearly easily manipulated fools and very misguided. They did something violent, but we don't know if they were manipulated into doing it.
This brings us to the Mideast, and there's some important developments that occurred in Syria recently. One is that Israel bombed inside Syria, with targets being Hezbollah and Iranians who are allied with the Syrian government. Could you talk about the Israeli bombing in Syria, March?
Israel has a history of conducting airstrikes in Syria. Most notably, many years ago, they blew up a suspected nuclear facility inside Syria. And then more recently, they've been blowing up what were believed to be convoys carrying Russian-made surface-to-air missile systems into Lebanon to supply Hezbollah, which would be a threat to Israel, because if Israel ever attempted to strike out Hezbollah, its greatest equalizing factor has been its air power, because we know from ground combat that took place in the recent Lebanon war, Hezbollah fighting through the Bekaa Valley in the south of Lebanon, Israel got its nose bloodied really badly. I mean, they lost a lot of troops and a lot of tanks and were not able to drive very deep into Lebanon, but what gave them the edge, what made them able to punish Hezbollah, was their air power. And certainly if the Lebanese, if Hezbollah were able to obtain Russian-made surface-to-air missile systems, this would negate Israel's air superiority. So Israel has had an obvious security reason for wanting to bomb inside Lebanon. Now, this recent strike presumably was to take out Hezbollah commanders. Israel claims they did not know there was an Iranian general amongst them, but that seems very hard to believe, considering if you have enough intelligence to say that these are Lebanese Hezbollah commanders, that then you say, well, we had no idea that there was going to be an Iranian general there. I mean, that just seems like a cop-out.
And we know that Israel has targeted places in Iran in the past, and they were behind that Stuxnet attack on the...
That's right, on the Iranian power facilities.
Iranian power facilities.
Exactly, and they've also been behind the assassination of several Iranian nuclear scientists. I mean, again, Israel never admitted to it.
Forgot about that one.
But every major news outlet on the planet and every reasonable analyst said, well, of course, it had to be the Mossad, because who else would have had an interest in blowing up Iranian nuclear scientists? And again, this was often tactics that were more sophisticated than at the hands of some typical terrorist organization. You know, the guy gets into his car, turns the key, and the thing explodes. Or the Iranian nuclear scientist who was shot right outside his home.
Sending a message.
And again, Israel feels threatened by Iran because, I mean, Iran has said Israel is our enemy. So naturally, I mean, feel that it is in their best interest to strike out at Iran. Now, at this stage, it does seem a little counterintuitive, considering the fact that ISIS seems to be a far greater threat to Israel's security as well as to our security and the security of the West. And Iran is fighting, and Hezbollah is fighting against ISIS.
Their alliances are very confused. And before we continue with this, I just want to remind listeners, if they just tuned in, that you are listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. I'm Ken McDermott Rowe, your host, and I'm here with Marshawn McDermott Rowe, our military affairs commentator, and Gus Cantavero, our producer. We started talking about the recent terrorist attacks in France, and we are now moved on to discussing the Israeli strike in Syria against Hezbollah and Iranian targets. And it's interesting, as we've reported for the last few years, that Iran has been a key ally of Syria. There are quite a few Iranian troops, and there have been for some time, in Syria, trying to help the Assad government fend off the attacks from Western-sponsored rebels. In addition, there are many Russian troops in Syria, and it's interesting from this recent article that there also appear to be Hezbollah, that would be Lebanese fighters in Syria, helping to maintain the Syrian government. How did Hezbollah get involved in the Syrian war?
Well, Hezbollah has in many ways been a proxy of both Iran and Russia. They are the Shiite militia, but also the Shiite political party that is one of the strongest parties in Lebanon right now. Now, it is worth mentioning that unlike other parties that are based very heavily Islamically based, they are a democratic party. While they have the military capacity to topple the Lebanese government, they still believe in obtaining power through more or less democratic means. You know, you might be able to reach an understanding with a group like Hezbollah. You might be able to give them a quid pro quo. You might be able to say, listen, if you agree to acknowledge Israel, we'll agree not to bomb you into a pulp, sort of a thing. And the same thing with Assad. Assad had no intention of ever attacking Israel. Now, unlike Hezbollah, which has had a history of fighting wars against Israel, so you can understand where the fear lies with Hezbollah, Syria did not. Syria has never attempted to, not since 1973, has not attempted to invade Israel. So, you know, again,
well, Syria was on that. Yeah, I'm sorry, March, but Syria was on that hit list that General Wesley Clark revealed shortly after 9/11. This was a hit list of seven countries the United States intended to overthrow in the ensuing years. It included both Syria and Iran, as well as Iraq and Libya, Somalia and Libya. The irony here, and I think you were alluding to before, is that by intervening on behalf of the rebels in the Syrian war, Israel is contributing to the support of radical Islam.
Well, not only are they supporting the radical Islam, but they're also turning attention on themselves when there was no attention on Israel.
How do the Israelis rationalize that?
I can understand some of the apprehension towards trying to cut a deal with Hezbollah because, you know, they fought several wars against Hezbollah, particularly with Syria. You know, you're talking about a country that has by and large been at peace with its neighbors. It's a government that is more interested in domestic stability than it is in attacking its, you know, the countries that border it.
So and it's secular.
Most importantly, it's a secular state and it's a multicultural state. The Christians lived at peace under Assad. So logic would suggest that we can do business with Assad. Why would we give guns and money to people who, A, their stated goal is to wipe out Israel and to attack the West? It's not like Iran, which has a little bellicose and, you know, but they haven't actually done anything yet. These guys have actually attacked the West. These guys say they want to wipe out Israel. They say they want to wipe out any democratic Muslim governments, and they want to wipe out the United States. I mean, this is backing these elements that also, mind you, Syrian Free Army, every time we give these guys guns, and this is reported in Reuters, the Associated Press, and Bloomberg, when we give these guys guns and money and training, they then take that money, training, and guns and go and swear allegiance to ISIS. So yeah, it is completely counterintuitive.
Well, they take the money and guns that we give them and they parlay that into becoming a big fish within what they see as the winning side, ISIS.
And speaking of training, the United States has announced it's going to send up to 1,000 soldiers to the Mideast over the next 4 to 6 weeks to train fighters for the war in Syria. These fighters are supposedly to combat ISIS, which is trying to overthrow the Syrian government, and to help the anti-Syrian government forces achieve a, quote, political solution to the war. So it's, on one hand, they're supposed to be fighting ISIS, but ISIS is fighting Assad. So maybe here, Marshawn and Gus, the United States has this rather tenuous strategy that we need to overthrow Assad. That's part of the strategy or the objectives that General Wesley Clark talked about. Overthrow Syria, then Iran will be vulnerable as it loses its key regional ally. And Iran is the ultimate goal for this Middle Eastern strategy because it has the greatest amount of natural gas and oil combined in the world, with the possible exception of Russia. So if you see that as the grand picture, then your short-term expedience is we cooperate with radical Islamists, whoever we can find useful, in order to get rid of Assad. And once we've gotten rid of Assad, we'll ensure that the, quote, moderates, unquote, actually govern the country.
It's so peculiar how we have this hierarchy of importance. It's like, number one, we get rid of the people we don't like. Number two, well, we haven't thought that far.
Or they have this kind of overly optimistic view of our ability to control the situation.
And that's, I think, the biggest problem when we look at the situation, because as I mentioned, from a long-term perspective, it's completely counterintuitive. And I've said it before, I said it in an article I wrote for the Army Times, that, you know, Iran, Syria, Russia, at the end of the day, they're modern countries. And the people of these countries would rather have a flat screen TV and an SUV than have a war. So you can cut a deal with them. Again, it's realpolitik. We did the same thing with the Soviets. If we were so narrow-minded, we would have invaded the Soviet Union. But we didn't, because we knew in the long term we had to cut a deal with
Marshawn, them. Well, Marshawn, as you mentioned in that article in the Army Times, it would be wise for the United States to realign itself in a very important way. We should be allied with Russia and Iran against these radical Islamists.
Well, maybe not allies, but at least
we should be cooperating,
not enemies of.
We should be cooperating them because we all
free
share...
Free trade, yeah.
We all share a hostility towards radical Islam. Of course, the Russians...
We can all agree there's a much bigger threat.
Yeah, and with the Russians and the Iranians combined with us, I think we could put this thing down
and
pretty
quickly. And at this point, it's basically that Iran and Russia have been participating at odds with the United States. So it's almost like there's like four or five different factions here all trying to stab each other in the back.
And I think that the struggle against ISIS is really kind of submerged in the larger geopolitical struggle between the United States Russia for hegemony.
That's right.
And I think that's what it's about at the end of the day. From a short-term perspective, we're looking at, well, we can deal with ISIS ultimately later, but let's get rid of Assad, let's hem in Iran, and they'll keep the Russians out, and then, well, we'll figure out ISIS when we get to it. But from a long-term perspective, look, Russia has, we have all this bellicose rhetoric about Russia's actions in Ukraine, but Russia has never attacked the United States. Russia is not threatened to attack the U.S. Russia is not saying it's going to bomb our cities. This isn't the Cold War anymore. Russia is not communist. It's not our inherent geopolitical enemy. There is no rational or sound reason why we should be aligning ourselves with terrorists. Let's face it, it's Al-Qaeda Incorporated in Syria to fight against secular, multicultural Russia. I mean, it's completely, in the long term, it's counterintuitive. And ultimately, once ISIS gets the chance, it will hit us and it will hurt us badly.
Well, Marshawn and Gus, I think we raised this issue in the press and we raised it in this radio show because we think there should be a debate in this country over whether we should have a fundamental rethinking of our foreign policy and whether we should be having this continuing, increasingly dangerous confrontation with the Russians.
Yeah, it's very one-sided right now. And I think, yes, Putin is a bit of he's an authoritarian. He does not tolerate too much dissent. But Russia, as it stands right now, could be a hell of a lot worse. And I think that we should be thankful that Putin has shown as much restraint as he has, because given the amount of prodding and poking from the West, the United States and NATO, if a crazier person was running Russia, I think they would be reacting in a much more severe, violent way, don't you think?
Absolutely, guys. I mean, yes, I think that we really are pushing the Russians pretty hard. We've managed over
between
the last
the sanctions
few years,
and the currency wars.
The sanctions, the currency war against the ruble, and also if you look at the former Warsaw Pact that was the Soviet Union's Eastern European alliance, almost all those countries are now been incorporated into NATO.
Into NATO,
and
really
the last holdout, which NATO is trying to get a hold of, is the Ukraine. So, Marshawn, could you talk about the current military situation in the Ukraine?
The situation in Ukraine has escalated tremendously. On, I believe it was the 18th of January, the Ukrainian government launched an all-out offensive against the east of Ukraine. And Petro Poroshenko, the president of Ukraine, said this is a final push to regain government control over the whole east of Ukraine. Well, the Russians basically said, we're not going to be taking this. And I began to read reports on January 19th and January 20th saying more or less that Russian troops had been spotted in the fighting in eastern Ukraine. And in fact, actually, it was reported in both Reuters and the Associated Press, the Ukrainian government's claiming that they're engaging thousands of Russian troops. Now, the Ukrainian government, if up against simply rebels, they can, you know, they can push them back. But now that the Russians are bringing regulars, and in fact, there have been reports, and I've seen the photographs taken by Russian troops participating in the fighting for the Donetsk airport, and they're wearing all of their unit insignia, which is something these Russian quote-unquote volunteers have never done before. They've never worn their insignia into battle. And these particular fellows were wearing the insignia of the Russian Marines. The situation is spiraling very rapidly.
4,700 people have been killed since last April when this violence started. And just to remind our listeners, it was at the beginning of last year that the elected pro-Russian president of Ukraine was overthrown in a U.S.-backed coup d'etat. There were cell phone conversations between our Assistant Secretary of State Victoria Nuland and the U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, which essentially they were trying to figure out who they would pick as the next and leader of the Ukraine. What kind of military involvement, Marshawn, do we have in the Ukraine war?
Well, right now, the U.S., along with several other NATO countries, have advisors in the far west of Ukraine, the area of Lviv, training Ukrainian troops. And in fact, actually, it was reported in Russia Today that the commander of U.S. Army Forces Europe is traveling sometime this week to Kiev with a delegation. According to Russia Today, is traveling sometime this week to Kiev, which is, again, a very much a statement to the Russians that we are very involved. And President Obama even said he wants to expedite Ukraine's ascension into NATO. There are no rigid guidelines for a country to join NATO. In order for a country to join NATO, it just has to demonstrate how it will contribute to the security of Western Europe and that it is it will be beneficial for the rest of Europe if it joins NATO.
So basically, if it creates a lot of opportunities for NATO to go fight somebody, then that's a good membership qualification.
Exactly.
We're likely to be attacked by Russia. Well, oh, you're perfect.
Then, of course, then if the NATO agreement was actually invoked in order to get NATO involved in the war in Afghanistan, I believe.
Oh, yeah.
And the idea being that the U.S. had been attacked and that the NATO's alliance
right.
must come to our defense right. by invading Afghanistan sounds right. a little like a bit of a stretch. But if Ukraine were part of NATO and there are Russian troops fighting in the Ukraine, then it seems like there's a pretty good case that NATO's yeah. got to go to war in the Ukraine, which must scare the Germans because I don't think they want war with Russia, right?
The flaw, though, of course, we weren't attacked by the country of Afghanistan.
No.
Just in case anybody out there gets that idea. Okay.
Yeah. How did the Germans feel about the admitting Ukraine into NATO?
Well, there right now, the German government, Angela Merkel, is treading a very fine line because on one hand, she wants to remain on the United States' good side. On the other hand, I don't believe she really wants to get involved in a war against Russia. But the interesting thing is what we're seeing now because of this is the rise of, in Germany, it's Die Linke, the left, which is the successor of the East German Communist Party. They're growing in popularity because the average German doesn't want to go to war with Russia. Because for Germans, there are people alive today who remember the arrival of Russian troops in Germany. They remember the siege of Berlin. They remember the price they paid for fighting the Russians. And in France, we're seeing the rise of the National Front, which again is a party that does not want war with Russia. And similarly in the UK, the rise of the UK Independence Party, they don't want war with Russia either. Very rapidly, what we're starting to see is there's a lot of sentiment amongst the people of Europe that Ukraine's not worth it. And because historically speaking, the Russians occupied large swathes of Eastern Europe as a buffer zone to prevent any future Western invasion. Stalin even said that. Russia has no interest in marching on Paris. They really don't want to march all the way to Berlin. They will if they have to. But again, looking at Russia historically, they haven't gone into Europe and annexed countries just for the sake of annexing them. A lot of people are looking at this and saying, do we really want to provoke the Russian bear, give them a reason to attack us? The European militaries have been drained by participation in the wars in Iraq and the wars in Afghanistan. They're currently deploying large numbers of air and naval assets to fight against ISIS. They really don't have the capabilities to fight the Russian behemoth.
Marshawn, I just want to remind the listeners, if they just tuned in, you are listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. I'm Ken McDermott-Rowe, your host, and I'm joined here by Marshawn McDermott-Rowe, our military affairs commentator, and Gus Cantavero, our producer. We're on once a month on the fourth Monday from noon to 1 p.m., and our website is incontextreport.com, and a copy of the show will be archived at WPKN.org and Radio for All, which you can go directly to Radio for All and look up In Context Report and find out all of our past shows, or go to our website, incontextreport.com, and check out our various links. Marshawn, could you give us some historical perspective on Russia's state of mind, talking particularly about its past invasions from the Mongols on up?
Russia as a state, more or less, as a nation, has existed since the 12th century, since the founding of the Kievan Rus. Now, this is important to mention because Kiev was the original capital of the Kingdom of the Rus. One of the reasons why Crimea is so important is because it's where Prince Vladimir, the first prince of the Rus, baptized his entire nation into the Orthodox Russian Church. Prince Vladimir brought unity, and then the Mongols showed up. And when the Mongols showed up, they brought utter devastation. They burned Kiev to the ground. That's one of the reasons why Kiev is no longer the capital of Russia. That is when the city of Moscow was built and became really the seat of Russian power. From the beginning of Russian history, they're faced with what is really the equivalent of being hit with a nuclear bomb. I mean, the Mongols wipe everything out, and this leaves a scar on a nation's psyche. But then they kick the Mongols out, and suddenly they find themselves being invaded by the Poles at one point, by the Teutonic Germans on the other hand. So they're constantly fighting off invasions all through the Middle Ages. During the time of Peter the Great in the 17th century, they're fighting the Swedes, they're fighting the Turks. I mean, they're just, you know, they're constantly at war with their neighbors who are trying to hem them in. The Swedes were desperate to keep the Russians from getting access to any kind of port on the Baltic Sea. The Turks were trying to keep them out of the Black Sea. So they fought wars with the Turks and the Swedes. Very shortly afterwards, we find Russia's invaded again by the French, and the French burn Moscow.
It's under Napoleon's time.
Exactly, during Napoleon's Grand Armée's march to Moscow. And the Russians eventually throw them back out in the 1840s, the Crimean War. So this is, people who still remember the Siege of Moscow, 1812, are now watching as the British and the French and the Turks land in Crimea to seize the Crimea from the Russians. And then after that, we get, you know, eventually the 1905 war, the Russo-Japanese War, where the Russians and the Japanese fight a war over control of Manchuria, and the Russians lose to the Japanese. So again, we see all the way up, really starting from the 12th century to the Russo-Japanese War, pretty much a period of almost constant invasion. And then we have the First World War, where the Archduke of Austro-Hungary is assassinated. Austro-Hungary invades Serbia, a Slavic state. Russia declares war on Austro-Hungary and Germany. And, you know, World War I kicks off. The Russians fight bloody battles against the Germans, and then this leads to the Russian Revolution. Now, the Russian Revolution is very crucial because what came out of that was the Russian Civil War. The armies of many, many Western nations invaded Russia, ostensibly to protect the Trans-Siberian Railroad, but in reality, they were killing Soviet soldiers. It was the armies of the United States, France, Britain, Japan. It was the armies of Italy, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Czechoslovakia was participating, Romania, all of the Western nations pretty much invaded the Soviet Union. Now, nominally, Churchill said, are we at war with the Soviet Union? No. But are we killing Soviet soldiers on Soviet soil? Yes. That was a fact of the Russian Civil War.
In the 1920s, the United States was part of an international army inside Russia trying to overthrow the Russian government.
Exactly. We were supporting the white Russians led by Admiral Kolchak and then various other generals they were known as the white Russians because they were supporting the Tsar. I mean, imagine if during our Civil War, during the American Civil War, you were to have had Russian and French and Austro-Hungarian and Prussian troops fighting on either the side of the North or the Confederacy. Well, let's say they were fighting on the side of the Confederacy, the side that lost. It would be a very traumatic experience for the nation because it reaffirms that mindset that the world is out, that the Western powers, not necessarily the whole world, but the Western powers are out to get us. The white Russians lost, we withdrew our troops, but about 400 Americans were killed during fighting in Russia during the Russian Civil War in the 1920s. We weren't just there guarding some rail lines. They were actively participating in combat against the Soviets. And then, of course, we go up to World War II and the German invasion of Russia. No nation suffered as much as Russia did during World War II. People in Leningrad were resorting to cannibalism in order to keep resisting the Germans. These people are still alive. People who are still alive remember fighting through the sewers of Stalingrad. They remember the battles of Kharkov, of Kursk. This plays a very important role in the Russian psyche, that if we leave ourselves vulnerable, the outside world will attack us if given the chance. So that's why we look at Russia and we say, well, you know, their economy is hurting because of the sanctions. Why aren't they overthrowing Putin? Well, because to the Russian mindset, what we are doing is waging an economic war, an economic invasion against them. By us bringing NATO to their doorstep, by us bringing our troops closer to Russia's borders, in their mind resurrects the memories of the invasions of the Russian Civil War, the invasions of Napoleon, the invasions of the Mongols, and of course, the invasion of the Germans. That is why what we're doing is so provocative.
You were talking particularly about the Ukraine, which for most of the 20th century was part of the Soviet Union. And as you pointed out, at Kiev at one point was the center of the Russian civilization.
Ukraine's almost always been part of Russia. I mean, they do have their own unique cultural traits and unique linguistic traits that's, you know, unique to them. But it's not unreasonable to think why there are so many ethnic Russians there. And it's not unreasonable to think why the Russians view it as part of their homeland historically.
One of the interesting wrinkles of the Ukraine situation, March, which comes out of a World War II situation, is that some of the U.S. allies in the Ukraine are enemies of the longtime enemies of Russia in the sense that they were collaborators with the Nazis. One of our firms, this is Blackwater, it's now called Academy, is reportedly going to be hired by the Ukraine government to train a battalion, which will involve a group called the Patriots of the Ukraine, a paramilitary branch of the neo-Nazi party headed by Andrei Beletsky in the Ukraine. So we're really getting involved with the most rabid anti-Russian elements of Ukraine who have ties to the Nazis.
Boy, it's never a good sign when Blackwater gets involved.
During the Cold War, we harbored a man named Stepan Bandera, who is a hero to the people in Western Ukraine because he was leader of the Ukrainian independence movement. He was a rabid anti-Soviet. But what's not well known is he was also a Nazi collaborator. He took part in the killing, the ethnic cleansing of Russians and Jews from Ukraine. But he was harbored in West Germany by the United States until eventually he was assassinated by the KGB. But there are statues being erected to him in places like Kiev by these radical militants. And these elements also are rabidly not just anti-Russian, but they're anti-Semitic too.
Well, of course, this all seems to be stemming from a decision which was made at the end of the Cold War that as the Soviet Union collapsed, Gorbachev's efforts to convert the Soviet Union into a democratic socialist state with voluntary membership by the republics failed, I think partly because of unrest encouraged by the Bush senior administration. When that Cold War ended, the United States under President Bush senior saw the opportunity to assert global hegemony. And I think that we are today as really 24 years into that campaign, 25 years into that campaign, to take advantage of Russia's weakness in order to basically control the important natural resources of the world. If we continue along this road, it seems that we are going to end up in a war with Russia, and that is something we definitely do not want. But as we contemplate the possibility of war, we have often in the show talked about the relative military strength of the United States and Russia. And one interesting story that relates to that are the recent reports that the F-35, this extremely expensive new aircraft for the United States, still doesn't work. Could you talk about the F-35 and how it matches up to our current plane and, importantly, Russia's current aircraft?
Well, the F-35 is supposed to be one of the most advanced jets in the world. The problem is, though, is it's plagued with defects. They found they couldn't fly too close to lightning because the fuel tank would explode. Now there are computer difficulties, the navigation system difficulties. We've been pouring billions into this project, and it's still not combat capable. In fact, there are speculations that it might not be combat capable for another 6 years or so.
The latest problem is that the onboard cannons do not work because of a software problem.
Now, meanwhile, because we unveiled this project, the Russians and the Chinese, they realized, oh my gosh, this thing's more advanced than the F-22, which is right now the most advanced fighter the U.S. has. And they said, we gotta play catch up. So they've revamped and remodeled the Su-25, which has been one of the longest serving Russian aircraft, but it's constantly being upgraded, constantly, because everything the Russians manufacture is modular. So the idea is that you can pull stuff apart and add in new pieces without having to completely junk the aircraft. So the new Su-25M, I believe it's called, is, they believe, although again, there's always speculation because these two aircraft have never faced each other in combat, but supposed to be believed to be as sophisticated as the F-35. And similarly, the Chinese developed the J-20, which looks like a carbon copy of our F-35. Now, how well these things would match up against the F-35 in combat, nobody knows because they haven't faced each other. But the fact is that both the Russians and the Chinese have their version of the F-35, and ours still is not combat capable. And if they're even close to being as sophisticated as the F-35 is, then that means they would be able to outstrip currently anything we have in our arsenal.
If I want to add that I shared an article on the In Context Facebook page, which I recommend everybody goes and likes because I share articles on there all the time. But it's from the RussiaInsider.com, and it's obviously going to be a Russian-slanted website. But be that as it may, it's got some pretty good information in there, and they make a very compelling argument how the F-35 is, mainly because of its delays, but partially because of its design, it's taken so long with this cutting-edge technology to actually come into service that it's actually already outdated. And they say that the F-35, when it's been wargamed against the Su-30, every scenario that the F-35 has been wargamed against the Su-30 flankers, the Russian aircraft have emerged winners. America's newest stealth aircraft, costing $191 million per unit, is riddled with such critical design flaws that it's likely to get blown away in any shootout with the supermaneuverable Sukhoi.
The Russians have centered their whole military now around a very realistic, practical war with the United States.
Right.
Before, during the Cold War, it was about outspending each other. It was about out-impressing each other, really. But now, the Russians are looking at the practical fact of we may be fighting the Americans. So now their technology is oriented towards circumventing American technological capabilities.
Excuse me, Marshawn, I just want to remind listeners, if you just tuned in, you're listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. I'm Ken McDermott Rowe, your host. I'm joined by Marshawn McDermott Rowe, our military affairs commentator, and Gus Canavera, our producer. In this program, we review the global wars, the geopolitical events that relate to them around the world, and we also try to give you some historical background so that you can place these conflicts in context. And we also comment on what the developments imply for the national security of the United States and global stability generally.
I need to add a couple of interesting points about the F-35 just to back up what you're saying about how the Russians are planning on a logistical fight with the Americans in practice, not just in theory. Because the thing with the F-35 is that it depends very heavily on the stealth practice and the beyond visual radar capability, and it carries a very heavy payload of only a few heavy missiles because they have beyond visual radar capability. They have a lot of fuel on it, makes them very heavy. They can only carry a few of them. Now, these planes are meant to be a multi-purpose airplane, and they're going to replace all the other jets in the fleet, but they're so damn expensive that we're going to have to downsize the fleet overall. And we're also going to have to spend way more money training the fighter pilots without actually putting them in the plane because they're so expensive and so difficult to maintain. So that means only 60% of the fleet is going to be on active duty at any time. The rest of them are going to be grounded trying to maintain this very expensive, hard-to-maintain stealth coating. So we're going to actually be putting ourselves at a disadvantage by employing the F-35, which will slow us down, which will make us less active in the air because they'll have a smaller payload, and it'll be more expensive to maintain. And the SU-30s are going to be out there doing circles around these heavy, slow planes that the pilots are not even trained to fly.
William Hartung of the Center for International Policy questioned the basic design of the F-35, saying that the plane would be too small to function as a bomber.
That's right.
And it's too cumbersome in dogfights.
It's only going to be able to carry 4 missiles.
During World War II, the best tank in the world, bar none, was the German Tiger tank. Many years ago, I talked to a veteran who had been part of an anti-tank crew in the U.S. Army during the war, And he told me that the only thing that would take out the Tiger was a airplane bomb. I mean, these things were the best tank. Problem is, though, is they were so expensive and difficult to produce, the Germans couldn't make enough of them. Yeah. Meanwhile, the Russians were turning out their T-34s. Oh, yeah, like it was nothing, you know. And the T-34 wasn't a terrible tank. It wasn't a King Tiger, though. But the fact is the Russians could produce so many more. And in that same vein, one of the things to bear in mind is right now, our armed forces is at the smallest it's been since before World War II. And the fact is that the Russians held a snap drill in Kaliningrad, which is an enclave on the Baltic, and they mobilized. It was about 120,000 troops in 24 hours. They held another snap drill in the west of Russia, where they mobilized 400,000 troops, like 900 tanks. It was an obscene number of aircraft, like 600 helicopters. All in, like, they mobilized them in a 48-hour period. Now, by contrast, for the United States to mobilize our National Guard and Reserve, because guaranteed we would need every single soldier we had, would take months, because these soldiers need train up, they need to be equipped, they need to be prepared to go fight. So if you look at the Russians, if they were to launch a blitzkrieg-style attack against the Ukraine or against any of our allies in NATO, if they decided we've had enough with your sanctions and we've had enough with your stepping on our doorstep, we're going to hit back, we would be hard-pressed to mobilize troops in enough time to stop the Russians before they reach Warsaw and Poland. Militarily speaking, we don't have the numbers. We don't have the capabilities. We only have one tank division that still remains. I mean, we demobilized all of the other armored divisions, and the Russians have hundreds.
Yes.
You can go on all day about how great our M1A1 Abrams battle tank is, but at the end of the day, if there are five American tanks, they're in the Baltics. If there are five of them and there are 900 Russian tanks, you got to admit the odds are not in our favor, you know? I mean, you don't have to be a military scientist to figure that one out. And then, as you mentioned, if we only have a handful of F-35s that are not capable either as bombers or for dogfights, I mean, and the Russians mobilize 800 or 600 aircraft, it's a no-brainer who's going to win that fight. Another example is the Japanese Zero was one of the best fighters of World War II. Again, though, the Japanese just couldn't produce enough of them.
Japan is going to buy 70 F-35s, and they currently have 100 F-15s. Now, they're going to have to downsize their Air Force 30% just to be able to maintain these much more expensive F-35s. So this is a perfect example of how we're going for this high-cost alternative that's really just making a hell of a lot of money for Lockheed Martin. It's not a better alternative. It's just a more expensive one. In fact, it's a worse alternative. The stealth coating is already outdated because you mentioned Russia has rolled out these brand-new anti-air missiles, which they are the best anti-air missiles in the world. They've already caught up to the capability of the anti-stealth capabilities, or the stealth capabilities of the F-35, rendering it useless. We've spent so much money on this project, and it's already outdated. What's the point?
Now, Marshawn and Gus, we're coming near the end of the show.
Oh, darn it again.
And one subject we need to cover is Afghanistan, a country where the Russians were defeated during the Cold War, and we, of course, invaded it in 2001. And in 2011, after 10 years of occupying Afghanistan, President Obama declared that the United States had achieved its objectives in Afghanistan and would withdraw all of its troops by 2014.
What objectives?
However, we've recently learned in December that over 10,000 U.S. troops will remain in Afghanistan in 2015. And this happens as there are increasingly bold Taliban attacks all over the country, including Kabul. Marshawn, could you talk about how we fared in Afghanistan? Have we achieved our objectives? And what's going to be the long-term effect of our invasion of Afghanistan?
The stated long-term objectives were to build a self-sustaining Afghan government and a self-sustaining Afghan army that would be able to provide their own security and yada, 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 right? Well, the reality is the Afghan army, I mean, anybody who's ever seen the Afghan army in action, these guys are not capable soldiers at all. They are not professionally trained. When we invaded Afghanistan, we took Karzai, who was a warlord, gave him a whole lot of money and a whole lot of guns and said, build an army. That's pretty much what we did. And so the Afghan security forces are incapable of resisting the much better equipped, much more experienced Taliban. Because you got to remember, the Taliban, many of these guys had fought the Soviets. They had fought us, and now they're going up against these ill-trained and ill-equipped Afghan forces. And I remember talking to an older Afghan gentleman who he was probably in his 60s, but he remembered when the Soviets were there. And he said, yeah, you know what? The Soviets were really brutal. Like, but the one thing I will say for them is they built a strong Afghan army, because the Afghan Red Army was a force to contend with. I mean, they lasted longer than the Soviet Union did. And that's something worth noting, is that the Afghan Red Army held out until 1994. The only reason they collapsed was because the Soviet Union fell and nobody was supplying them with arms anymore. They held their own, and it's because they were professionally trained. On the other hand, this Afghan security force cannot hold its own. Afghans I've talked to have said, you know, when America leaves, the Taliban's going to come back. And they say it sort of just nonchalantly, like, well, that's a fact.
Can 10,000 American troops keep the current pro-American Afghan government in power?
Probably. I mean, at least keep control of Kabul. How much of the country we actually have any, or the Afghan army has any actual control over, is highly debatable. Once the last American soldier leaves, it'll be like the fall of Saigon. The Taliban will come sweeping in, and the Afghan army will collapse. The Afghan army is riddled with corruption. People who are illiterates are being made generals because their family has money. The Afghan generals, many of them are on the take from the Taliban. Others make their money growing opium. These are not guys who are going to be willing to die fighting the Taliban.
Right.
The generals are going to go leave and go to their retirement homes in either Italy or California.
Yeah, nice.
And the country is going to fall apart. And the poor Afghans who supported us, the ones who really believed in our mission there, are going to be the ones who have to pay the price when we leave.
I recommend that the listeners read journalists like Patrick Coburn or Mitchell Prothero, both of whom have relayed really good stories about how a lot of these guys are part-time fighters. They drive taxi cabs, they're farmers, they're goat herders, whatever. They go and they fight for a couple of weeks, then they go home.
These are the rebels?
Everybody. This is how they all do it, all over the Middle East. From Syria all the way to Afghanistan, they are part-time fighters, except, you know, obviously in Iran, they have a professional army and so forth. But, you know, these guys, they go, they join the resistance for a little while, they fight, they shoot, then they go home.
Right.
You know, and it's back and forth. And that's why it's impossible for an army like the United States Army to actually occupy and quote-unquote defeat these people, because you can't defeat them. They don't actually have a standing army. They show up, they fight, they rattle the cage, and then they go home.
And of course, as we've shown in previous programs, the Afghans have a long history of resisting invaders.
Yeah.
They were invaded by, Alexander the Great had...
They're pretty stubborn people. He barely
made it through the country, and the British were defeated there a couple of times, so they're not an easy foe.
It's an imperial graveyard.
Exactly, and it's not a country that lends itself to any kind of occupier, and it doesn't matter what your ideology is or why you're in there. The fact is it's an incredibly difficult country to fight in. And again, unlike Iraq, for example, which was a very modern country, which, you know, to their credit, the Iraqi army has been holding its own. I mean, with the help of the United States and Iran and even Russia, the Iraqi army has been holding their own. Afghanistan, things like democracy and, you know, Western-style government, to them, that's an outside idea. It's not an Afghan idea. When dealing with Afghanistan, you need an Afghan solution to an Afghan problem.
So what happens to Afghanistan? Solution. Let's assume the United States eventually loses its occupation of Afghanistan. Do the Afghans fall under the influence of the Russians, the Chinese? Do they maintain an independent foreign policy?
Afghanistan, historically speaking, has been ruled by warlords who, you know, they've had an emir or somebody who's been in charge of the country, but generally speaking, they tend to have a very sort of isolationist policy. Now, the exception to this, though, and the big X factor here is the fact that the Taliban, reports have surfaced over the last week or so, that the Taliban, both Afghan and Pakistani Taliban, has sworn allegiance to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the head of ISIS. If the Taliban were to decide to throw their weight in an offensive against Pakistan after, let's say, seizing Kabul, throw their weight in an offensive against Pakistan or against Iran, they could pose a sizable threat, because the Afghans historically don't venture too far beyond their borders. They would go and raid neighboring Pakistan. They would raid Iran. But it is a nation of fighters. If they were to throw that resources behind somebody like ISIS, that could be very dangerous, and that just gives even more reason why we should not be supporting these guys who invariably go and join ISIS, because ISIS is the one entity which could give the Taliban the reason to start venturing out of Afghanistan.
That's it for this edition of the In Context War Report. Thanks very much, Marchand. The In Context War Report is produced by MDR Productions, Inc. and is broadcast at noon on the fourth Monday of the month on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. This program will be archived at WPKN.org, at radioforall.org, and on our show's website, incontextreport.com. And you can sign up for podcasts of the series via iTunes and Radio for All. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and write to us at ken@mdrtalk.org. On behalf of In Context Military Affairs commentator Marchand McDermott Rowe, producer Gus Cataferro, this is your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
See ya.